Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter. I'm going to continue my slog through Leviticus by today covering Leviticus chapter 22, verses 1 through 33. I'm going to call this A Priest Holiness, Part B, because Part A was in the last chapter, how to keep a priest holy, how he had to obey the Levitical law. In the last part of this chapter 22, we will look at what is and what is not an acceptable sacrifice. So let's start now with Leviticus 22, verses 1 through 3. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell Aaron and his sons to be careful with the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they dedicate to me, so as not to profane my holy name. I am the Lord. Say to them, if any man among all your descendants throughout your generation approaches the holy gifts which the sons of Israel dedicate to the Lord, while he has an uncleanness, that person shall be cut off before me. I am the Lord." Now God speaking to Moses, this is still at the beginning of the doorway of the tent of meeting of the tabernacle, as described in chapter 1, and that almost every chapter of Leviticus starts that way. Now this chapter that God is going to speak to Moses concerns the perfection of two things, the priest and the sacrifices, the sacrificers and the sacrificed. Now the priest, the holiness of the priest, we talked about in chapter 21, we're going to finish up here at the first part of chapter 22. Tell Aaron and his sons, God tells Moses, tell Aaron. Of course, Aaron's in charge of the priesthood, so he's the one that's likely going to, he's the one that needs this information, to be careful, the NIV says, to respect the holy gifts of the sons of Israel. The gifts would include the sacrificial offerings and also the priests, which the portions, also the portions which the priests got to eat, for example, the sin offerings for the male, for the leaders of Israel and for the ordinary common people, and also the peace offerings they got to eat, those part of the sacrifices, and also the parts which they couldn't eat. For example, a burnt offering went all the way to the Lord. They had to be careful with all that. The main way we're going to see that they're going to not be careful with the gifts of Israel is by offering a sacrifice while they're unclean, or eating a piece of the sacrifices that they are entitled to when they're not clean. Now, of course, they could be unclean by a million different ways. They could touch a dead person. They could sit on a bed where a menstruating woman would have been. We've been through a jillion of these examples in previous chapters. The point is, they got to be clean. Now, verse 3 says, "Say to them," God tells Moses to tell Aaron, "if any man among all your descendants," the NIV says descendants. John Gill says this word, Hebrew word there, can mean descendants, whether male or female. That might be true, but let's face it, he's talking about the priesthood here. And so if he's talking about the priesthood, the priests aren't going to be women. They're going to be men, so it makes sense to translate it as the NASB did, as man. Holman Christian Study Bible also translates it as man, although I can't believe that it would not apply to a woman or even to a non-priest also. But he's especially focusing on the priest here. Now, if you do something when you're unclean as a priest, the punishment is getting cut off. And again, cut off can either mean exiled or killed. I think there are too many examples of where cut off means killed that you can prove it means killed. And so generally when I see the word cut off, I think killed. Now, this idea of being clean when you deal with the Lord's sacrifices is reflected in the statement by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, "The multitude of minute restrictions to which the priest, from accidental defilement, were subjected by keeping them constantly on their guard lest they should be unfit for the sacred service, tended to preserve in full exercise the feeling of awe and submission to the authority of God." Now, I mean, why, we might want to ask, why single out the priest for cleanliness? There are other places in the law where people are clean or unclean, such as menstruating women or a man with a seminal discharge, etc., etc. Why single out the priest here? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says the following rules for uncleanliness, which we're going to look at in this first part of the chapter, were already passed for people in general. Why does the law need to repeat it for priests? The answer is because priests had the power to shelter themselves from the application of the law. I mean, they're the ones that are doing the law, and if they were unclean, they could do a sacrifice, and who's going to call them on it? Maybe another priest might, but that might be sticky. So by emphasizing the priest in particular had to obey the cleanliness regulations of the law, it showed that the priests were not above the law and that they would have to obey it just like everybody else. We go now to Leviticus 22 verses 4 through 8. "No man of Aaron's descendants who has a skin disease or a discharge is to eat from the holy offerings until he is clean. Whoever touches anything made unclean by a dead person or by a man who has an emission of semen, or whoever touches any swarming creature that makes him unclean, or any person who makes him unclean, whatever his uncleanness, the man who touches any of these will remain unclean until evening and is not to eat from the holy offerings until he has bathed his body with water. When the sun is set, he will become clean, and then he may eat from the holy offerings, for that is his food. He must not eat an animal that died naturally or was mauled by wild beast, making himself unclean by it. I am Yahweh. Now, once again, in verse 4, it says, no man of Aaron's descendants. That word includes women. But as Ellicott said, as I said just previously, and Ellicott backs me up on this, this is primarily written for priests, and priests weren't women. So let's just look at this as the priest. So man is fine. God's Word translation uses descendant, as does the NIV. I can't help but wonder if they're affected by the feminoxyism, the effinism, as I heard one person call it, that is inundated our corrupt culture, but I won't accuse them of that. I mean, technically, apparently, John Gill was long before feminism, and he said that the word includes women too, but still, it's talking about priests, so we will continue to say this is priests who have a skin discharge or an emission of semen, of course, which women would not have, at least not all the women I've ever heard of. So it's talking about priests. And this is examples of how you can become unclean. And these are just examples. Anyway, you become unclean, but you're touching a swarming creature like worms or something, or maggots, dead animal, dead deer by the side of the road, whatever. Dead person sitting on something that an administrating woman has sat on. You're unclean. You got to be unclean until evening before you can take up your priestly duties again. Now, unclean till evening, I think, is a general rule, because you can look at Numbers 19:11 and read this. Whoever touches the dead body of any human being will be unclean for 7 days. Why 7 days in Numbers 19:11 and only one day here is something I can't answer. And of course, this is one of those questions that my commentators completely ignore. After I look through 10 of them and can't find anything on it, it's irritating. But it could be that this one day of uncleanness is just a general rule from the ordinary cases of uncleanliness, but Numbers 19:11 is more specific, that if you touch a dead body, you're unclean for 7 days. Maybe I'll find a commentator to talk about it when I get to Numbers 19:11. Now, the priest is to wash himself with water after he becomes unclean. James Fawcett Brown say this, quote, the book of Leviticus abounds with examples which show that in all the ceremonial washings as uncleanliness meant, as uncleanness, he says, meant loss of privileges, so baptism with water indicates a restoration to those privileges. Of course, washing water makes you clean, so you can do your priestly duties again. 4, verse 7 says, for that is his food, the holy offerings being referred to, the holy offerings is his food. Remember, the priests didn't have a way of making a living, so they got to share in the sin offerings, some of the sin offerings which they ate in the courtyard, and of course the breast of the peace offerings, and the fish for all the priesthood, and the right foreleg for the officiating priest. Those meals were eaten in the priest's home with the offeror, maybe in the offeror's home with the priest, outside of the courtyard of the temple. It was their food, and some people say that they were only unclean for only one day, because to make them unclean for more than that would mean they would be deprived of food. They couldn't go to the temple and sacrifice animals and get to share in the peace offerings, and so it might hurt their families' sustenance. So it was only one day. Now, the prohibition against eating animals torn or mauled, as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it, you can only imagine the disease in such animals. I just saw a deer yesterday riding my bicycle on the side of the road, and oh boy, did he stink. He stunk from so far off, and there were 1,000 flies on his body. I can't imagine anybody eating an animal that's been torn to pieces. That deer had been hit by a car, I'm sure. But remember, I don't think that disease prevention was the main point of the law. The main point of the law was to stay away from death and blood and anything that represents life or death, because that's the purview of the Levitical sacrificial system. And we want the system to have to do with life, not death. We go to Leviticus 22:9. They shall therefore keep my charge, as the priest, so that they will not bear sin because of it and die thereby because they profane it. I am the Lord who sanctify them. Now, verse 9 makes it sound like the cutoff that I mentioned in verse 3 is not banishment or exile, but rather death. Leviticus 22:3. Anybody that's unclean approaches the holy offerings, that person will be cut off from my presence. Dead, dead, dead. Remember, Nadab and Abihu struck dead because they offered strange fire? Well, I think this probably fits in the same category. Now, one might wonder, how does this punishment, death, square with unclean until evening? Well, the lesser punishment of being unclean came from unintentional errors, where somebody accidentally touched something that would make them unclean. That's not sinning with a high hand. But if you go ahead and offer a sacrifice once you're unclean, well, then you are sinning intentionally with a high hand. And so the punishment is much more severe. We go now to Leviticus 22, verses 10 through 11. No layman, however, is to eat the holy gift. A sojourner with the priest or a hired man shall not eat of the holy gift. But if a priest buys a slave as his property with his money, that one may eat of it, and those who are born in his house may eat of his food. Well, the holy gift, that would include peace offerings, which is mainly in focus here, but with sin offerings too. You've got to be a priest to eat those sin offerings that we eaten in the courtyard by the priest. No layman could do that, obviously. But now let's talk about peace offerings. Peace offerings were eaten by the family of the offeror, as well as by the family of the priest. And so here we see a sojourner with the priest or hired man shall not eat of the holy gift. Now, what this means is that the priest eating with the family, the offeror and his family, they could eat that food, no problem. That's what peace offerings were for. But if the priest has an alien, a sojourner in his house, staying with him from a different nation, or if he has a servant working for him, a hired man in his house, they're not part of the family, so they don't eat. And that's kind of the distinction. Are you part of the family? In fact, layman in verse 10, translated layman by the New American Standard Bible, the NIV translates that word as no one outside the priest family, which of course would include a sojourner or a hired man. They're not supposed to eat the peace offerings. Now, John Gill makes a fine distinction about sojourner. He said, that's talking about somebody who's a boarder who's staying there over a long time and is not part of the family, he can't eat. But, he says, a guest for a short period of time, it would be senseless to keep him out of the meal. Well, the NIV translation of that seems to cut against Gill's opinion because the NIV says, a guest with the priest, a hired man, shall not eat of the holy gift, a guest. So I guess we can leave that one up in the air. I suspect the NIV is right. Guests can't eat of the holy food. They just have to fend for themselves, I guess. Now, verse 11 says, a slave can eat of the holy food, the peace offering. Now, ironically here, a slave has more rights than a sojourner. Why is that? Because the slave is considered part of the family. Genesis 17:13, a servant who is born in your house or who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. When you circumcise a slave born in your house, well, that sort of makes him like part of the family. And so, therefore, they could eat the peace offering food. And, of course, the female slaves could eat, too, as John Gill points out. So, it seems the organizing principle here is if it's the priest family can eat the holy food. But if not, that's a no-no. The priest has made himself unclean. Leviticus 22, verses 12 through 13, if a priest's daughter is married to a layman, she shall not eat of the offering of the gifts. And here we go again with family. And layman here, that's in the ESV translation, the NIV has anyone other than a priest. So if a priest's daughter is married to a non-priest, she shall not eat of the offerings of the gifts. Why is that? Because she's no longer in the priest's family. She's moved to a different family, a non-priestly family, and therefore she's not qualified to eat the holy gifts. Verse 13, but if a priest's daughter becomes a widow or divorced and has no child and returns to her father's house as in her youth, she shall eat of her father's food, but no layman shall eat of it. Well, if you've got a priest's daughter who's married into another family, she can't eat of the priest's peace offering meals while she is married because she's in a different family. But if she comes widowed and divorced, she goes back to her father's family, well, then she's back in the priestly family again, and she can eat the holy offerings. Now, there's another situation here. Another condition is that she is widowed and divorced and has no child. Why? Because if she had a child, somebody else would be responsible for taking care of that child. For example, the widow might be remarried, or the widow's brother-in-law might have married her because of levirate marriage and thus taking care of the child. So the priest has to take care of his daughter if she's widowed and divorced and childless, but as soon as she has a child, she's somebody else's responsibility. Now, I'm thinking, what about the case where the priest's daughter is widowed or divorced and has a child, but she hasn't found a kinsman redeemer and hasn't found anybody to marry her yet, and so she's kind of stuck with that child. She can't come back into the priest's house. That seems a little harsh. And so I wonder whether the law here means that the priest's daughter has no child and accompanying male support of that child. That's what is implied. So therefore, if she had a child with no accompanying male support, she could come back to her father's house and eat the holy gifts. We go now to Leviticus 22, verses 14 through 16. If anyone eats a holy offering in error, he must add a fifth to its value and give the holy offering to the priest. The priest must not profane the holy offerings the Israelites give to the Lord by letting the people eat their holy offerings and having them bear the penalty of restitution, for I am Yahweh who sets them apart. Verse 14, if anyone eats a holy offering in error, the NASB, that's the Holman Christian Study Bible, the NASB translates that as unintentionally. If anyone eats a holy offering unintentionally, and that would be easy. You got the breast of the lamb sitting on a table right next to the other parts that you can eat, and you just make a mistake and grab the wrong part. The priests are only supposed to eat the breast, not everybody else, and somebody grabs the wrong part. Or what if you were a priest, but you weren't the officiating priest, and then you ate the right foreleg of the lamb, which belongs to the officiating priest, not to the priest in general? Well, you've screwed up. You didn't mean to do it, because this is unintentional, in error. Well, as most unintentional crimes are covered by the guilt offering, the so-called trespass offering, the one that offers restitution, it says he, the offending person here, whether it's a priest or a non-priest, doesn't matter, he must add a fifth to its value and give the holy offering to the priest. So let's say a layman ate some of the breast of the lamb, which was a peace offering. He's got to figure out what the value of that breast was and add 20% to it. Either 20% in kind, the breast plus 20% more of a breast, or commute it to money and give him the value in money. The fifth, the 20%, that's standard for sin offerings, Leviticus 5:16. And sin offerings, I should have said trespass or guilt offerings. King James has it trespass. Modern translations have guilt offerings. Some translations call it a restitution offering. But the point is that is the offering that's very similar to a sin offering, except that the person offended against gets 20% from the person who offended, a fifth part. Leviticus 5:16, he shall make restitution for that which he has sinned against the holy thing, and shall add to it a fifth part of it and give it to the priest. Now, giving it to the priest, one might think that means going back to the temple later on and adding 20%, and it could be, I guess, but John Gill suggests right there at the meal, you figure out the size of the piece of meat that you ate that you weren't supposed to eat, then you add 20% and get some more meat that equals 20% of the volume of that first piece of meat that you weren't supposed to eat, give it to the priest, and then he can carry that back to the sanctuary. I don't know what you would do with the meat there. Give it back to the sanctuary. Would you burn it on the altar? Probably not. If the meal was in the offeror's house, I guess you could give it to the priest and he could take it back to his house. That probably makes more sense to me. Verse 15 says in the Holman Christian Study Bible, the priest must not profane the holy offering. The New American Standard has they must not profane the holy offerings. And so if it's they, it could either be the children of Israel in general or the priest in particular. The NASB is not specific. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it specifically as the priest must not profane the holy offering. Now, how would the priest be profaning the holy offerings, letting somebody eating a sacrificial gift at the wrong time in the wrong place or the wrong part of it? How would that be profaning the holy offerings? Well, John Gill says, in particular, it would be by negligently making it easy for someone to eat the holy food by mistake. Maybe they should put a sign up here. This belongs to the priest. This is the breast. Leave it alone. Now, verse 16, there's some translation differences in verse 16. Verse 15 says, the priest must not profane the holy offerings. Verse 16, by letting the people eat their holy offerings. And that would go along with what I just said, that's how you profane the holy offerings, is by negligently letting the people eat the wrong meat. By letting the people. letting is Holman Christian Study Bible. NASB has a different translation. It says by causing the, so NASB says, so and so cause them to bear punishment for guilt by eating their holy gifts. Well, that means that it's more, the NASB translation makes the offense more a matter of intent rather than negligence. I think the Holman Christian Study Bible translation makes more sense. Just the priests are negligent, and that's typically what happens with restitution offers, is for sins of negligence or sins that were not meant to be, not intended to be. I must point out, though, here that restitution offerings, guilt offerings, trespass offerings, it is often said that there is no offering for intentional sins. Yes, I have found several examples of offerings, intentional offerings, guilt offerings, trespass offerings to cover intentional offerings. For example, a breach of security, a bailment offense. There's some others too. A man who fornicates with an engaged slave got to offer a sin offering. That is not unintentional. There's others also. We go down to verses 17 through 21, Leviticus 22. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel, and say to them, any man of the house of Israel or of the aliens in Israel who presents his offering, whether it is any of their votive or any of their freewill offerings, which they present to the Lord for a burnt offering. And I'm going to stop here and say that burnt offering has caused or causes a huge problem. Why? Because votive and freewill offerings are peace offerings. So we're going to spend some time trying to deal with that. Verse 19, for you to be accepted, it must be a male without defect from the cattle, the sheep, or the goats. And that's the requirement for a burnt offering. Verse 20, whatever has a defect, you shall not offer, for it will not be accepted for you. When a man offers a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord to fulfill a special vow or for a freewill offering of the herd or of the flock, it must be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no defect in it. Once again, verse 17, the Lord speaks to Moses. Verse 18, and God tells Moses to, verse 18, speak to Aaron, because Aaron's in charge of the priest. He needs to know this. Now, let's go to this problem in verse 18. Let me read it again. Any man of the house of Israel who presents his offering, whether it's votive or free will, those are peace offerings, presents his offering, whether a votive or free will peace offering, which they present to the Lord for a burnt offering. Why does it say burnt offering when votive or free will offerings are peace offerings? Well, I'm going to give you four options on how to answer this or to resolve this problem. And I'm telling you, I have spent a lot of time struggling with this because the doggone commentators don't talk about it. I often wonder, is it because they can't answer the problem they don't talk about it, or because they're so learned it just the answer is so obvious to them that it's not worthy of mention? I don't know. Well, let's start with the first option on how to reconcile that phrase burnt offering when it looks like it's referring to peace offerings by looking at Maimonides' solution. Of course, Maimonides is the famous Jewish scholar, medieval scholar. I think he's 11th century AD. He's quoted in John Gill, and what Maimonides said is, aliens were sacrificing sojourners, as we see in verse 18, any man of the house of Israel or of the aliens in Israel, and the aliens are presenting their sacrifices, and aliens, of course, were Gentiles. And the only offering that could come from a Gentile was a burnt offering. I don't know how Maimonides knows this, but that's what he says. And so since the only offering that a Gentile offers is a burnt offering, therefore these peace offerings are considered to be a burnt offering because they're burnt up completely. The Gentile doesn't share in the meal. Well, that seems totally screwy to me. I had a friend of mine, when I suggested this to him, he said, that sounds like rabbinic machinations or machinations. Yeah, well, I agree. I think that's, I don't buy that for a minute. So let's go to option two. Why are these votive and free will peace offerings called burnt offerings? This is my suggestion. Perhaps the term burnt offering is here used in a non-technical sense. After all the offerings were burnt in the physical sense. So maybe burnt offering is a broad term that includes any offering burnt on the sacrifice. It's not a technical, precise term for a burnt offering, one of the five major types of offerings. It's not referring to the one of the five major types. It's just referring to all offerings that are burnt up on the altar. And peace offerings are burnt up on the altar. And so this solution would say, verse 18 says, any votive or any freewill offerings which they present to the Lord for a offering that's burnt on the altar. And that sounds very cool. Got a little problem, though. Verse 19 says, for you to be accepted, it must be a male without defect. And that is a requirement for a burnt offering, not for a peace offering. And so my solution falls flat on the ground. I was so disappointed when I realized that. Leviticus 1:3 says, if the offering is a burnt offering, it is a male without defect. But peace offerings could be female. Leviticus 3:1. If his offering is a peace offering, whether male or female. So that option is not going to do that. We take burnt offering in a non-technical broad sense to cover the peace offerings mentioned here. That's not going to do. So let's go to the third option. Now, I got this option from a PhD friend of mine named Artie Hall. He has a PhD in ancient biblical languages. He knows all kinds of stuff that I don't. I don't know a word of Hebrew. He says that after examining the question that I presented to him, he said you could translate that term burnt offering as a verb, to go up or ascend. So here's how the verse would read. Verse 18, any man of the house of Israel or of the aliens in Israel who presents his offering, whether it is any of their votive or any of their free will offerings which they present to the Lord to go up or ascend. Well, that's just a variation of my previous solution, which says that it's an offering which is burnt, because votive and free will peace offerings are burnt, or votive and free will offerings are, they do go up and ascend, and so you just broaden the definition of burnt offering to include those votive and free will offerings. The problem with that solution is the same problem that I had in my previous solution, is verse 19 gives the requirements for a burnt offering, not a peace offering. So if you translate this, their vow of free will peace offerings which go up in smoke, you've taken care of that problem. But it doesn't explain why in verse 19, this vow or free will peace offering which goes up in smoke must be male, because peace offerings could be female. So that doesn't answer it either. My friend, after I told him what my solution was to expand the definition of burning to a non-technical sense, and of course he offers this going up or ascend as a variation on that theme, he said, you may have resolved the question of the ages. No, I didn't. But now I'm going to give you my fourth solution. Notice none of these are coming from commentaries. I'm really sucking wind here. What I did is I went to Leviticus 22:18, second part of the verse, to verse 19. I went to a literal translation, since I don't know Hebrew, Young's Literal Translation. And I wanted to see if I could read it somehow to make sense of it. So here's what I did. I put a parenthesis. I made the reference to vow offerings and willing offerings, free will offerings, made that parenthetical. So let me read Young's Literal Translation. Any man of the house of Israel or of the sojourners in Israel who bringeth near his offering, that means his burnt offering, parentheses of, as in a subset of, all his vow or of a subset of all his willing offerings, close parentheses, which, now it's referring to the burnt offering, because I've put a parenthesis in there, who bringeth near his burnt offering, which they bring near to Jehovah for a burnt offering. Now, that is a neat and simple solution, in my humble opinion. I am not a biblical scholar. I don't know how to do all this stuff. I can't write commentaries. But that makes a lot of sense to me. The of all his vows, the burnt offering, which is a offering amongst all of his other offerings, all of his other offerings, which include vow peace offerings and free will peace offerings. We're going to take the burnt offerings, which he's taken out of all those other peace offerings, and these burnt offerings will be brought near to Jehovah for a burnt offering, it's going to be a male of the herd. Well, that's a thorny question. I'll leave that one for you in case you want to get a PhD in Old Testament. We go now to, well, before I leave this verse, I'm going to give you a little rabbit trail here. What were the genders required for the Levitical sacrifices? I went through and picked them all out in trying to deal with this problem here in verse 18 and 19. So I might as well give them to you, even though it's not directly on point. A burnt offering. They were all male. Leviticus 1:3, if its gift is a burnt offering from the heart, is to bring an unblemished male. Easy. All right. How about a peace offering? Now, peace offering could be male or female, Leviticus 3:1. If his offering is a fellowship peace offering sacrifice, whether male or female. Sin offering. Sin offerings were all male, except for one. A female goat or a female lamb for the sins of a commoner. Sins of a leader of Israel was a male goat. For the high priest and all the congregation was a bull, which is male. a leader, a tribal leader, would be a male goat, but the sin of a common Israel person was a female goat or lamb. Female goat, Leviticus 4:28, if someone informs him about the sin he has committed, then he is to bring an unblemished female goat. Leviticus 4:32, or if the offering he brings is a lamb, he is to bring an unblemished female. So there you have sin offerings. Female in the case of sin offerings for the common people. Now, how about a guilt offering? That's easy. They're all male because all guilt offerings were rams. And a ram, by definition, is a male lamb. So every now and then you could have a female animal. All of them must be without defect, as verse 19 says. Why? Because the sacrifice typifies Christ, who was the perfect sacrifice. And so we see here that the same perfection is required in the sacrifice that was required in the priest. We go now to Leviticus 22, verses 22 through 23. Those that are blind or fractured or maimed, it means those animals that are blind or fractured or maimed or having a running sore or eczema or scabs, you shall not offer to the Lord, nor make of them an offering by fire on the altar to the Lord. And that's obvious, because the sacrifice would be imperfect, cannot represent our perfect sacrifice, Jesus. Verse 23, in respect to an ox or a lamb, which is an overgrown or stunted member, you may present it for a free will offering, but for a vow it will not be accepted. Now here we have a major problem. Well, first a minor problem, the translation of ox, that bugs me. The reason is because if you look in English, the definition of an ox is an adult castrated male bull. Well, here we say, in respect to an ox, you may present it for a free will peace offering. I don't think so. I don't think it's a castrated male. We just read in a previous verse that no castrated animal could be offered to the Lord. In fact, I'm trying to find it where it says no crushed testicles. You can't offer an animal with crushed testicles. I think that's coming up here in just a minute. Let me see if I can find it. There it is. It's the verse 24. Anything with its testicles bruised or crushed. Well, an ox is castrated. So why translate it as ox? The NIV note says the word, Hebrew word translated ox, can include male or female. Well, the English definition of ox does not include females. There are no such things as female oxes. An ox is an adult castrated male of the genus Bos, according to dictionary.com. So, I think that translation, while traditional, is confusing. The NIV, I think, translates it as, well, they translate it as ox too. I'm going to stop recording right now and see if I can find a better translation. All right, I just found the ESV translates it as bull. That makes sense to me. Now, that's a minor problem. Now let's look at a bigger problem. Verse 23 says, if you've got a bull or a lamb which has an overgrown or stunted member, that means one of his legs is too long or one of its legs is too short, you may present it for a free will offering, but for a vow offering it will not be accepted. Well, allowing an animal with a leg that is too long or too short, allowing it to be presented for a free will offering, does that not violate verse 21, which says, when a man offers a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord to fulfill a special vow or for a free will offering, it must be perfect to be accepted. So verse 21 says you got a vow or free will peace offering, it must be perfect. The sacrifice must be perfect. But here in verse 23, it's not perfect. It has an overgrown or stunted member, but you may present it for a free will offering, but for a vow, it will not be accepted. All right, let me summarize that again. Verse 21 says, for a free will offering, there must be no defect. Verse 21. Verse 23, you may sacrifice as a free will offering an animal that has an elongated or stunted limb. Now, that seems to present an obvious contradiction. How do we resolve it? Option number one is to say that the translation is not accurate. The translation should be, if thou shalt offer it either for a free will offering or for a vow, it shall not be accepted. Some scholarly support for that, Adam Clark suggested. Here's Benson, the commentator. Quote, the Hebrew here will bear a different translation, which indeed seems necessary to reconcile this with the 21st verse. Namely, shouldst thou offer it for a free will offering or for a vow, it will not be accepted. Well, is that the way out of the problem? I don't know Hebrew, so I'm not sure. Well, let's go to the second way we might reconcile that. Some people say the free will offering is not prescribed by law. In other words, you don't have to do it. It's free will. Just whenever you feel like giving thanks to God, you can do it. And so If you give it of your own free will, a defective animal that has a leg that's too long or too short still has value. There's no type of Christ as a perfect sacrifice. This was not a sacrifice for sin or anything. And so it's okay if you have a defective free will offering, as verse 23 says. But that still doesn't solve the problem with the contradiction, the apparent contradiction of verse 21, which says a free will offering has to be unblemished to be acceptable. There must be no defect in it. So that doesn't really answer it. Let's look at option number 3. Jews thought that none of these defective animals were ever sacrificed. What they did was they sold the animal and gave the money to the priest, and so therefore they weren't actually sacrificed as a matter of fact. The problem with that is, if you say that verse 23 says you may present the deformed animal as a free will offering, you may present it in the form of a money payment after the animal is sold. How do you reconcile that with verse 21? Verse 21 says, when a man offers a sacrifice of a free will offering, it must be perfect. Well, I guess the distinction is in verse 21, he offers a sacrifice, it's got to be perfect if he burns it, but if he just gives the money value of the sacrifice in verse 23, it doesn't say you may sacrifice it, it says you may present it for a free will offering. So you're just presenting the money value of it, you're not sacrificing it, so there's no contradiction. Well, I guess that's logically possible. However, I don't think it's likely in my humble opinion. Here's what I think the best reconciliation is from Matthew Poole. He says that an elongated or stunted limb in verse 23 is not a disqualifying defect, but the defects of Leviticus 22:22 are disqualifying. So in Leviticus 22:22, we see this. You are not to present any animal to the Lord that is blind, injured, maimed, has a running sore, festering rash, scabs, all that stuff. That's what makes it defective, and you can't present any animal like that. However, if you get down to verse 23, it's not talking about that kind of animal. It's talking about an animal that has a leg that's too long or too short, which is not the same thing. It's not as bad. That makes perfect sense to me. Verse 23 is talking about an ox or lamb, an animal that doesn't have any of these other bodaciously awful defects. The defects that are mentioned in verse 22, blind, fractured, maimed, running sore, eczema, scab, doesn't have that, just got a leg a little bit too long, too short. So we're going to let you offer that for a free will offering. All right, so if that's the right answer, then we have another problem. Why may you present such an animal as that with a long or short leg for a free will offering, but for a vow offering, it will not be accepted? Well, John Gale says the reason for this is in order to show that a vow offering is a little bit more serious than an ordinary free will offering. Now, I'm going to tell you how vow and free will peace offerings are alike. Both are given in anticipation of future events. A Thanksgiving peace offering, which is not mentioned in verse 23, but a Thanksgiving peace offering is given in respect of a past event. I just give thanks for something that God has done for me in the past. But that's not an issue here. In verse 23, we are trying to distinguish why, when you've got an otherwise okay animal except for the length of his leg, why is it okay to present him for a free will offering but not for a vow offering? Well, I just gave you how a vow and free will peace offering are alike, both in anticipation of future events, but how are they different? The free will peace offering is giving for a prayed for future event, whether it's fulfilled or unfulfilled. Oh God, please let me win the lottery next year. Well, hasn't happened yet, but I'm going to thank you anyway. That's a little bit different than a vow peace offering. A vow offering says to God, if I win the lottery next year, I will give you my vow offering at the temple. So in that case, the vow offering is given in response to a prayer that is actually already fulfilled by God. So it's more serious to ignore an offering when God answers a prayer affirmatively. And so that means you can't even offer an animal that has a long or short leg. It's got to be perfect. That makes a lot of sense to me. We go now to Leviticus 22, verses 24 through 25. Also, anything with its testicles bruised, or crushed, torn, or cut, you shall not offer to the Lord a sacrifice in your land, nor shall you accept any such from the hand of a foreigner for offering as the food of your God. For their corruption is in them. They have a defect. They shall not be accepted for you. Bruised or crushed testicles, that means it's castrated. It could be bruised or crushed without being castrated, but that would include castration. You shall not offer as a sacrifice, obviously, because that means it's not a perfect sacrifice like the antitype. Jesus is perfect. You cannot accept any such defective sacrifice from the hand of a foreigner. Why would a foreigner be offering food on the altar, sacrifices on the altar? John Gill says this is who this foreigner is. Quote, a Gentile, a proselyte of the gate, who had renounced idolatry and was willing to offer sacrifice to the true God. Proselytes of the gates were people who weren't circumcised, but they were following the moral, and in this case, sacrificial laws of the Jews. We go now to Leviticus 22, verses 26 through 28. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, when an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall remain 7 days with its mother, and from the eighth day on it shall be accepted as a sacrifice of an offering by fire to the Lord. But whether it is an ox or a sheep, you shall not kill both it and its young in 1 day. Now here in verse 27, the NIV for ox has calf, which, as I said, the ESV has bull. I like that much better. And think about this. Verse 27, when an ox is born, castrated bulls aren't born. They're not castrated when they're born, so it's a calf. These are the three, ox, sheep, and goats are the three types of animals used in the Levitical sacrifices, as we know by now. The little baby animal is to remain 7 days with its mother. Seven is the typical number for perfection, so after 7 days, it's considered to be perfect and mature. And then on the eighth day, it should be accepted as a sacrifice. You can sacrifice it then. Why the distinction between a young 7-day-old animal and an 8-day-old animal? Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, and Clark say this. Animals were not considered mature nor good for food until the eighth day for humans. So to offer an animal younger than that would show contempt for God's religion. If those animals were unfit for the people's food, how much more would they be unfit for God's food? Now verse 28 says, whether it is an ox or a sheep, you shall not kill both it and its young in 1 day. Why? Here are some options. First option, humanitarian reasons. NIV Study Bible and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mentioned this. Well, I don't believe that. Humanitarian sounds like 21st century rhetoric being carried back to the past. Oxen, sheep, and goats aren't human, so why are you talking about humanitarian? And besides, it was all right to kill one of the animals if 7 days had passed by, or it was all right to kill one of the animals and leave the other one alive. Well, how is killing an animal humanitarian? Is that humanitarian? You kill the animal. Is killing humans humanitarian? No. Is killing an animal humanitarian? It has nothing to do with humanitarian or not. Now, unless you're a PETA animal rights extremist fool who thinks it's wrong to eat a steak, well, that's one thing. But most normal people understand that this has nothing to do with humanitarianism, so I don't think this is a proper suggestion. One could, to salvage this option as a reason for the law, is to say that if you treat animals with kindness, this is a great object lesson for humans. John Gill says this would encourage mercy and pity and discourage cruelty, because people that are cruel to animals are often cruel to people. Now that I could go along with. Maybe it's an object lesson for humans to be kind. I don't think so, but that's reasonable. Here's a practical reason, option number two, as to why you don't kill a sacrificial animal within 7 days of the birth of its young. NIV Study Bible says saving the mother would build up the flock. Well, but the problem with that is killing the mother after 7 days was okay. How's that going to build up the flock? Don't think that's going to do it, not in my mind. Here's the best option, in my opinion, according to the NIV Study Bible. This prohibition against killing an animal's young within 7 days of its birth was to avoid an otherwise unknown pagan custom. A lot of times when you see these weird laws, you can bet it had something to do with a pagan custom that God was reacting against. We go now to verses 29 through 33. When you sacrifice a sacrifice of thanksgiving to the Lord, now thanksgiving, now that's a peace offering, a different kind of peace offering than the vow peace offering and the free will peace offering. This is a thanksgiving peace offering. You shall sacrifice it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten on the same day. You shall leave none of it until morning. I am the Lord. So you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. You shall not profane my holy name, but I will be sanctified among the sons of Israel. I am the Lord who sanctifies you, who brought you out from the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. Now this eating on the same day of the thanksgiving peace offering, that is a repetition of the requirement from Leviticus 7:15, which says the same thing. The thanksgiving peace offering, remember, was an offering given for something that happens in the past. Now, that's distinct from the votive and free will offerings. You had 2 days to eat those, the day you sacrificed and the day after, but with the thanksgiving peace offering, you had to eat it all on the day it was sacrificed. Why the distinction? Here's what Ellicott, the commentator, says about that. Quote, as these votive offerings, or vow offerings, were an indirect mode of supplication having respect to future favors, and hence were not a spontaneous expression of pious devotion, they were not so sacred as the former.
He means as the thank offering.
They were, therefore, allowed to be eaten both on the day of presentation and on the following day. So Ellicott says this distinction is to show that vow and free will offerings, which have to do, as I mentioned earlier, have to do with prayers about what's going to happen in the future. Fulfilled prayers, vow offering, or unfulfilled prayers, a free will offering, that's different than thanking God for something that's already been done. Sort of the emphasis is on let's give God more thanks for what's already done for us instead of worrying about what we need in the future.
Let me try to make that a little clearer by quoting from the Jewish Encyclopedia under their article entitled Peace Offerings. Quote, the thank offering is a response to acts of divine beneficence. The votive and the free will sacrifices are connected with the expectation of benefit. And there's the difference. What Ellicott calls the future, what he means is that the votive and free will offerings are made with an expectation of what God is going to do for the offeror in the future. The votive offering is an offering in which the offeror makes a vow, and he says, I will pay you this vow, God, if you will do something for me. And the free will offering is not connected with a vow, but it's given with the expectation that God will do something for the offeror, the supplicant, in the future. However, a thank offering is not given in expectation of receiving anything. The thank offering is a response to acts of divine beneficence. In other words, God has just been so gracious and glorious, and I'm just going to thank him for it. So therefore, the thank offering seems to be a little bit more, or I should say a little bit less, self-interested than the votive and free will sacrifices. And therefore, Ellicott says, as a result of that, the thank offering has more sanctity attached to it, more holiness attached to it, and therefore the thank offering must be eaten within one day, whereas the votive and free will offerings can be eaten on the day of the offering and the next day. And of course, none of the offerings could be eaten on the third day.
Why had the animals in the free will or any of these offerings, any of these peace offerings, why did they have to be eaten quickly? Meat spoil quickly in the hot desert, that would defile the offering. It would encourage liberality to priests, because if you had more food than you can eat, well, let's invite more people over, more priests, more Levites, to eat this food up, because we don't have leftovers here. Didn't have refrigerators, plus God said it was illegal. Third reason why to eat the meat promptly, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, is to prevent a superstitious notion that there was some virtue or holiness in the offered meat, and therefore we'll keep the meat back and light a candle to it or something. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Leviticus 22, verses 1 through 33, a particularly difficult chapter, I think, with some difficult points in it. We are now ready to slog ahead to Leviticus 23, first part of the chapter, verses 1 through 22, Feast of the Lord, part A. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.